I, Lourdes Marianela de Leon, have decided to voluntarily return to my country, Guatemala, and I authorized for my son, Leo, to remain to complete the court processes in the United States of America. When he ends with the respective court, he shall be sent to Guatemala, and I will be expecting his return.
That's the transcript of an Immigration and Customs Enforcement form signed by Lourdes de Leon on June 4th. Lourdes is a Guatemalan woman who came to the U.S. seeking asylum. The form is indicating Lourdes' voluntary departure, otherwise known as self-deportation. In May, Lourdes was caught attempting to cross the border with her six-year-old son, Leo. She was picked up by the U.S. Border Patrol near Yuma, Arizona, and 2 days later, she was separated from her son.
Llegaron, el niño estaba dormido, y me dijeron que lo despertara porque él ya se iba a ir. Lo levanté y...
That's Lourdes describing giving her son one last bath before she was told he had to leave. They didn't give me more time to hug him or anything, she says. It's an inexplicable pain. According to ICE, on May 30th, Lourdes asked to be reunited with her son, even if that meant being deported.
Cuando yo la iba a firmar, yo le pregunté tres veces si era junto con mi hijo. Y las tres veces que yo le pregunté, él me dijo que sí.
She asked the deportation officer three times if she would be deported with her child. And the three times I asked, he said yes, she said. So on June 4th, Lourdes signed that document agreeing to leave the United States and return to Guatemala. On June 7th, she was deported to Guatemala, alone. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today we hear Lourdes' version of the story as told to us by Celia Mendoza, correspondent for Voice of America. Celia traveled to Guatemala to speak with Lourdes about her self-deportation after more than a month back in the country, and she has yet to be reunited with Leo, who remains in foster care at Cayuga Center's facilities here in New York. Celia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much, Tanzina.
So we, after speaking with Lourdes, we just sort of went through the timeline of events. What does she say happened?
She said that she came to the United States with her child. She used a coyote, which is basically someone that they paid to try to get them through Mexico into the United States. She said her trip was actually not as bad as you will think. Some of the cases are horrific stories about extortion and kidnapping. In her case, she said it was actually kind of calm and quiet most of the part. She came to the San Luis, Arizona border, and actually she said the person that brought her to the United States told her just walk, cross for about 10 minutes, and then the Border Patrol will come to you. Her intention was to give herself into the authorities of the United States to seek asylum. She actually told us that when she was there, they waited for a couple of minutes, and it was extremely hot there in Arizona, so they start walking, and at one point, they saw a Border Patrol agent truck, and they flag it down for them to get them. At that point, she said things kind of changed. She realized that it wasn't going to be as simple to be able to ask for asylum. She felt that even though she had proof and she was able to make it all the way there with her child, things are starting to go south, as she kind of described it.
And can you give us a sense of why she was seeking asylum in the United States?
She was escaping at the conditions in her town. She lives about 7 hours from the capital of Guatemala in the border with Mexico. It's an area that is impoverished. They don't have a lot of resources, but also she had a family situation that was forcing her to get out. One of the things that she said is that she had some threats against her life, and she wanted to make sure that her and her kid was safe from that.
So ultimately, Lourdes is in Guatemala, and her son, Leo, is in New York. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what recourse does she have to be reunited with him at this point?
This is the part that was very confusing for Lourdes and even for us to understand. She was deported, and when she arrived to Guatemala, she had no legal representation. Actually, she never had legal representation while she was detained, and she signed the papers. When she arrived, She didn't really know what to do. She said she went to the office of the foreign ministry asking for help. And she said she didn't really get a lot from them. She knew what her child was, and she said that was a blessing in the middle of everything, because most of the other mothers she spoke with, some of them didn't even know what the kids were. So she had continue asking and trying to get any answers. Now, after media got attention and she was able to speak to different outlets, she got legal representation, and they have been in touch with the Cayuga Center. One of the things that she said that is very confusing, not only for her, but her child, is the fact that he's going to have to go to court. He already was interviewed by Catholic Charities, which is the first step.
And let's be clear, he's 6 years old.
Exactly.
So the six-year-old is going to have to go to court by himself. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's something that she actually said he told her. He said, "Mommy, I don't understand what people are telling me. They keep telling me stuff I don't understand." And she said, he asked, "What's a judge?" They asked me if I have a lawyer. I just want to go back home. And that's the thing that he says, because what he said to her is, they keep asking me if I want to go back to Guatemala, and I keep telling them, I already tell them that I want to go back home. I don't know why I have to answer so many times. And that's what he actually keeps telling her every time they speak on the phone. They talk every 8 days, every time they do. She mentioned this as something that it really, really hurts her, is that he says, "Mommy, you have been taking too long with the papers." I believe she has told him that she's working on the papers to try to get him. And he keeps saying, "These papers are taking too long. When is the papers going to happen?" And she has been able to kind of get him to understand what the process is. And then the fact that now they have a lawyer helps a little bit, but she says that she still feels very alone in the process. And because she's so many miles away from New York, and she doesn't have the possibility as other mothers that have been able to get off out of the detention centers and bond to be able to go and at least see their kids. She actually, now this week is going to be 2 months that she has not touched, hugged, or see her child in person.
Do we know how many or how widespread this practice is of people deciding to, quote unquote, self-deport so that they can see their children again? I would imagine Lourdes is not the only woman that's doing this.
Exactly. Actually, she said the flight that brought her to Guatemala had at least a dozen parents that were in the same situation. It was two women and several men. She actually pointed out that the woman that came with her, she was from one of the indigenous groups here in Guatemala and did not speak Spanish very well. And what we have seen also is the misinformation, especially for those that were deported or arrived before the whole crisis was exposed and media took attention. Some of the people that actually was affected by the zero tolerance policy and didn't sign papers and were able to get help from groups or community leaders. Today, they have more of a support group, but people like Lourdes and the people that were deported with her, they actually feel very left alone.
Is there any help that Lourdes can receive when she's in Guatemala? Is the Guatemalan government able to help reunite her with her son?
That's a question we have tried to ask the authorities here in Guatemala. I have requested interviews with the Office of the President as well as the Foreign Ministry. They have not been able to accommodate us. They have not answered any written questions that we asked about. Yesterday, the Foreign Minister of Guatemala said that they are now working with the United States, the opening of an office of information and communication to try to get data about migrants and reunite families. It's something that they decided yesterday during this particular meeting in Guatemala that they were going to open. But beyond that, what we have heard from community leaders, people that actually help migrants here in the capital, but as well in the borders, is basically that they don't have any sort of group or agency that protect them follow their cases, are in contact with them. And that is something that we definitely saw in Lourdes' case.
And you mentioned that she has an attorney. Who is her attorney?
Her attorney is Michael Avenatti.
Oh, we've never heard of him before. No.
Exactly. It was very surprising for us when I was told that he was representing her. She said she was contacted by an organization in New York who is helping families, and they had a contact with the Avenatti firm, which, as we have been following the story, he went to the border when the crisis started, and he has been representing families. According to Lourdes, 60 families are being represented by Michael Avenatti pro bono. She's not paying for it. But also, the large amount of cases also generates that not every case gets as much attention as maybe a lawyer having just a few cases, especially when it comes to this in particular. We're talking about little kids in these centers. So that's something that she deals with. She wants more attention. Of course, her priority is her child. So she's grateful that she has a lawyer, and she's grateful that the process has started. But just this week, she was telling us that even though the social worker told her that her child will come back soon home, the latest she heard is that he will not have his court appearance until September. And that is driving her crazy right now, because she was expecting him to be here within the next few weeks. And now she will have to wait until September for his court.
And I just want to make sure I'm clear that there that Leo, who is 6 years old, will be in a courtroom in September, represented by an attorney. Mm-hmm.
That is what she said. She's trying to get that sooner than September, but the reality is that he's now facing his own process through the immigration system in the United States as a six-year-old. And if Leo did not have an attorney, we will see a six-year-old walking into the court representing himself without understanding what is happening, and probably just telling them and the judge what he has been telling everybody he has seen and who has interviewed him, which is, I want to go home.
Celia Mendoza is a correspondent for Voice of America, currently in Guatemala City, Guatemala. Celia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
In a hard-fought match, France defeated Belgium on Tuesday in the first World Cup semifinal. John Strong from Fox there with the call. It was a huge victory, not just for French fans, but for many on the African continent, where some of France's biggest stars have roots. Out of the 23 players on the roster, 12 have African ancestry. And in a country where anti-immigrant sentiment has been on the rise for years, the success of France's diverse roster creates a complicated relationship between fans and the players they're rooting for. Shireen Ahmed is a sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast.
There's people all over the world who are really excited. I follow on Twitter, we call it the football Twitter family, and are really recognizing that the last four remaining teams are, yes, European, but also have a huge, huge number of players of immigrant experience or first generation. And that really matters because of the relevant political situation in Europe.
12 of France's 23 players are of African descent. How have those players transformed French soccer, or dare I say soccer, football? Let me clarify that. How have they transformed the sport, and what's generally their sort of, how are they received at this point by French fans?
Well, that's a great question, but I think it's really important to just sort of backtrack a little and realize that they're not the first to bring this to the table. I mean, we had legends such as Raymond Kopa, Michel Platini, and the most famous Zinedine Zidane, who are all French players, were part of the tricolore, is what they call the French national team. And they were of immigrant experience or first generation. So this isn't the first time we're seeing this. So what's happening now is that it's more of a discussion, you know, on immigration and stuff, but it's really a conversation about race.
Right. And that's, and I think that that's something, given the politics on the continent of Europe right now, but particularly in France, and we're seeing it here in the United States, this sort of extremism, very, you know, hard right politics that are really influencing society. And I'm just wondering what those conversations are like among French fans. Like, is there sort of a cognitive dissonance when you're looking at who's on the team versus how French citizens or immigrants in France are treated differently?
Well, that's a really good point. And it's not exclusive to France. Let's remember Belgium, who, you know, was knocked out yesterday by France. I mean, they're unbelievably powerful, amazing player, Romelu Lukaku, who is of Congolese descent, has also famously said that if you're Belgium and you're a person of color, there's no way you have not experienced racism. And what he said was, when he performs well, he is the Belgian, you know, phenom. When he doesn't do well, he's Lukaku of Congolese descent. And that's very telling. So what happens is, you know, whether it's France or Belgium or even in Italy, as we've seen with Mario Balotelli, you can be theirs if you are doing well, if you are successful, if you are contributing, if you are making that country look good, they want you to be part of them. You are their son, in essence. And what happens is, if you don't live up to those expectations and you don't belong to them anymore, you're disposable. And I think that that's really a crux of an issue. And it's very important to hear these stories. And most French fans don't realize this. I mean, they get caught up in the passion. And yesterday I was remarking on Twitter, then Paul Pogba, who was fouled, fell down. You had legions of French people and probably the whole country jumping up and standing and getting really upset that he deserved a call. But I remarked that was probably the only time you would ever see random French people defend a black Frenchman who's Muslim.
Shireen Ahmed is a sports writer and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Thanks so much for being with us, Shireen.
Thanks for having me.
Lots of big questions this week on the show for you, but one of them was this. What are your thoughts on privacy and policing? How much privacy are you willing to give up for safety?
Hello, this is Bill from Seattle, and privacy is safety. You can't trade one for the other. Imagine somebody looking through your window or following you down the street or searching for your garbage. Do these things make you feel safe? No. Safety is privacy. Freedom comes with risk.
This is Spence from Indianola, Mississippi. I am willing to give up some privacy for security, such as general or random pat-downs at stadiums, airports, and such. I have hesitations, though, if a government entity wrongly declares an imminent threat and uses phone records, maybe bike records, firearm registration records to illegally, unethically target individuals. So it really depends on who gets to determine threat is imminent.
Hi, this is Meg from Nashville, and I think the less privacy we have, the less control we have. Linking privacy and safety together is a huge sham, and it's designed to trick the public into sharing their private matters out of fear.
Hi, my name is Glenn, and I'm calling from Seattle. Policing technology seems to be guaranteed to be used as a weapon against communities of color. I think I could accept tech that tracks cars, since they are weapons with a death toll equal to guns, but I cannot accept tracking people. The white justice system has many times over proven we cannot be trusted with that type of power.
All right, so what does this really mean for tracking people using their DNA? You may have been curious to see if your ancestry can be tracked back to Africa, Asia, or somewhere else on the planet. So you spit in a vial or you swab your cheek and you send it to a company's lab to test your DNA. But after you receive the blueprint of your DNA, what happens to that data? A recent case shows us that law enforcement could potentially use it to solve crimes.
Joseph James D'Angelo has been called a lot of things by law enforcement. He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer. Today, it's our pleasure to call him defendant.
The Golden State Killer case had gone cold decades ago, but in late April, law enforcement officials arrested Joseph James D'Angelo for a string of brutal rapes, murders, and robberies across California in the 70s and 80s.
KQED reporter Alex Emsley came on the show after the arrest.
These crimes occurred throughout the state of California, from north to south, and initially they weren't thought to have been related. And it was only through DNA testing that came about really a decade after the last murder that is attributed to this killer occurred that investigators started to put these pieces together and realize that all of these crimes likely had the same perpetrator.
And with this DNA, officials reopened the cold case. And with a few leads, law enforcement turned to a genealogical database called GEDmatch. They created a profile with the DNA evidence, as NYU professor Aaron Murphy described on this show back in April.
My understanding is they found at least a relative, it seems like a second cousin or something, and they traced up to a great-great-grandfather, and then they essentially went and mapped out the family tree, trying to use public information to rule out people who probably wouldn't be the suspect because of, say, the wrong age, the wrong gender, the wrong geographic location, trying to find someone in California who would fit the profile that they had of the killer.
Ava Kaufman is a freelance journalist and contributing writer with The Intercept, and she says cases like the Golden State Killer raise questions about how law enforcement is using DNA to solve crimes. As part of our week-long series on police technology and privacy, we're looking at DNA and how law enforcement's use of that very personal information has changed in recent years. Ava Kaufman took us back to the start, less than three decades ago.
DNA has been used since about the early 90s to catch criminals and also to find missing persons. And it is a really valuable and precise tool. It's not used as frequently as one would think, since for a long time, processing times have taken a while and, you know, the technology wasn't really at a level in which it could be, you know, rolled out and used cheaply. But that's beginning to change. And so we're starting to see the use of DNA technology even local law enforcement departments, you know, setting up their own databases now.
And so let's walk a little bit through this, because I think we hear a lot about it on television and in movies. You know, we have the DNA and now we know who the killer is, et cetera. But it's more involved than that. Let's talk a little bit about whose DNA is collected. At what point is DNA collected by police? And then how is that DNA generally stored?
Yeah, so until very recently, the main way DNA was collected was if someone was convicted of a felony, or if someone was a sex offender, or if someone was a missing person. And that DNA would be stored in the FBI's CODIS database, which stands for Combined DNA Index System. And that database has pretty strict regulations in terms of how often it can be searched and the actual location of the DNA, you know, on the chromosome that's collected in order to protect someone's privacy so that, you know, they were collecting an area of the chromosome that doesn't reveal sensitive health information. But now as DNA technology has become more widespread, we're actually seeing departments set up their own databases. And so we're getting this alternate system. They're kind of called rogue databases, where local departments, not subject to the same strict accreditation guidelines of CODIS, are collecting DNA from all kinds of people. So we're not just getting felons in these databases. We're getting witnesses to a crime, people who are pulled over at traffic stops and getting their cheek swabbed.
And I'm just curious, what rights, if any, do citizens have when they encounter a police officer or law enforcement officer who wants to take their DNA?
It's pretty troubling because in 2015, the Supreme Court ruled that there was no need actually for a warrant or to be convicted for your DNA to be taken, and that it counts as a reasonable search.
As I mentioned earlier, we're looking at the different types of technologies, and obviously DNA testing is one, as you've mentioned, that is increasing. One of the latest developments that we've learned about in policing has been the use of something called rapid DNA. And last year, Attorney General Jeff Sessions actually mentioned it at a congressional hearing.
Rapid DNA analysis, it presents tremendous opportunities to solve crimes in an effective way and can produce justice because it is a kind of thing that you can't fake or mislead. So I am very strongly in favor of that.
Ava, can you tell us exactly what rapid DNA is?
So rapid DNA is essentially taking an entire DNA lab and the usual two-week to several-month process. These labs have a lot of backlogs that may occur, and kind of miniaturizing it into a portable machine where all you need is to swab someone's cheek, you know, put that sample in a container, plug that tube into the machine, and in less than 2 hours, so, you know, maybe if you took a long lunch, you would get DNA results back. So these machines are pretty incredible because all of a sudden you have a portable lab you can take with you. You could easily exonerate someone. You could see very quickly whether someone, you know, should be held longer if they, you know, have a criminal record that matches with an identity already in your database. Rapid DNA was used in the Ghost Ship Warehouse fire in Oakland to identify bodies of people who passed away there.
Well, I guess in instances of a natural disaster, it would make sense as the one that you mentioned. But aren't there concerns about civil rights?
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, we don't necessarily have guidelines, certainly not on a state and local level, about how long these samples can be kept. So there's also concerns about, let's say a sample gets taken because you're an innocent person, and then it's still kept in this database and can be searched indefinitely and can lead to false matches, as you say. There's also concerns about, you know, forming a kind of database that would lead to ethnic or racial profiling. If rapid DNA kits are used more at the border than in other locations, that DNA is going to come from certain ethnic groups. If it follows the racialized trends in policing, we're going to see more Black and Brown people swept into these DNA databases who would then be subject to the possibility of false matches at a higher rate.
Fascinating stuff. Ava Kaufman is a freelance journalist and contributing writer with The Intercept. Ava, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Every year, about 1.5 million people start internships in the hopes of getting their foot in the door at their dream job. But about half of those internships don't pay. It was only last month that the Senate approved a $5 million fund to finally begin compensating interns on Capitol Hill. That money still needs to be approved by the House, but the effort was spearheaded by a nonprofit group called Pay Our Interns.
Being an intern on the Hill as a person of color, you realize that there are few people that look like you, and that's actually really disheartening. You know, the people that I could relate to were the individuals that were cleaning bathrooms or cleaning the hallways.
That's Guillermo Creamer, the chief of staff at Pay Our Interns.
You realize that the people who that don't look like you, you know, they all tend to come from a similar background. You know, they all have the extra funds to go out after work and to do happy hour. When I had to rush back to go to class because I was interning, working, and taking a full course load at the same time.
Guillermo was an unpaid congressional intern in 2014 and interned in the D.C. mayor's office the year after that. Beyond needing the money to live, Guillermo says that unpaid internships don't consider the discomfort that occurs when interns can't afford what's required for the job.
One of the things that happens when you're an intern, especially on the Hill, is you have to wear suits. You know, the one suit I owned was not a black suit, for example. It was kind of a greenish, tannish suit. So I knew whenever I'd rewear that, it was recognizable that I was rewearing the same thing. And so that was difficult.
Guillermo eventually had to drop his congressional internship to take a babysitting job. But today, he says being in an advocacy group means he can fight for everyone to have access to an internship that could launch a career.
Unpaid interns eventually become staffers. Staffers eventually become LDs or chief of staff. And that individual can then one day want to run for office. So allowing that gateway to be there, you know, it really stuck with them.
And it's not just DC interns, of course. All types of industries, including the media, use unpaid interns. I sat down with Ross Perlin, author of Intern Nation, to talk about what unpaid internships mean for this generation of workers.
I was an unpaid intern myself. Like the vast majority of people that I knew felt kind of pressured and even forced at a certain point to work unpaid, doing real work for a significant period of time. And it wasn't until then that I looked around and saw that, you know, everyone around me was feeling this pressure to do an internship. And I told my family what I was doing. And my grandparents said, "Oh, wonderful, you're going to become a doctor." And I had to explain to them, actually, no, this, you know, is now something that everybody has to do. Yes, the term comes from medicine. It was originally in the medical profession that there was this idea, but now it's everywhere. I told my parents, they understood that much. But when I told them I was going to do it unpaid, they said, "Unpaid? We've never heard of people working unpaid." So that's when I realized that this was a relatively new phenomenon just in the last few decades that it had become completely normalized. And it was something nobody had really talked about.
And what type of change did we see over the past couple of decades that's led to more of these unpaid internships?
In some ways, the most significant one was a cultural change by which, you know, this was an era of the decline of organized labor, of a lack of consciousness really about work and working conditions. There is a law around this. There is the Fair Labor Standards Act. Minimum wage is, you know, you have to pay that for people who work at least minimum wage. Of course, this was a period of minimum wage stagnation. And there was kind of this loophole basically where a traineeship or an apprenticeship that was really an educational experience could be unpaid for a short period of time. And through that loophole, you know, a giant truck was driven, and a whole range of industries just started to adopt this, not even understanding the legal situation. It was accepted, oh, this must be legal, this must be fine. And of course, it was a more competitive kind of economy, everyone trying to get into the white-collar economy where internships really took hold. In many ways, very positive apprenticeship model, which is much deeper in the blue-collar world and still is, was sort of forgotten on the way to the white-collar world, and no real robust, paid, equalizing path to white-collar work was established.
And so what are the implications of that? I mean, I did my first internship when I was 14 in financial services, not something that I've obviously gone into, but that was paid. Many people do not get paid internships. What are the implications?
So for young people, on top of rising student debt, record levels of tuition, youth unemployment being, you know, extraordinarily high since 2008, this has delayed a whole generation from kind of taking the steps, the traditional steps into adulthood, the traditional milestones of having an independent income and being able to, you know, have a secure place to live and establish relationships and so on. So it's had generational implications for those who've gone through it. It's changed the complexion of certain professions that...
Literally.
Yeah, literally. The complexion in terms of, you know, in terms of diversity, you know, who can enter these fields. So disproportionately affecting women as well, who are more represented in unpaid internships and in the fields where unpaid internships dominate, people of color, people from, you know, working class backgrounds who just cannot afford to work unpaid. You know, I think it's contributing to these record level of income inequality as well. So it's really kind of something that has insidiously worked its way into our whole society.
We've also seen some changes happening in the federal government when it comes to paying interns, which a lot of folks were even, I think, surprised that senators weren't paying their interns. What are other industries that particularly abuse this privilege? And I think we're sort of in one right now, right? Media?
Unfortunately, the media is one of these fields where I think as the media has struggled to, you know, to find profit in the digital realm and changing business models, this is often an excuse that different professions use, different fields, you know, when it's not clear how profits are going to be made or there's some kind of transition. Well, you know, at least we can get unpaid interns in there. Yeah, we don't have the budget to actually hire anyone there, but let's get some interns in there. Politics is definitely one. And this news from the Senate, that the Senate is finally deciding, I mean, they had grandfathered themselves sort of out where they had given themselves an exception. The amount of unpaid labor in politics is staggering.
And yet the amount of wealth in Congress is also staggering. We've done some reporting here that shows that there is a significant amount of wealth among the members of Congress.
Yeah, usually it's not a lack of funds really that is driving unpaid internships. It's just the feeling that you can get away with this. And so unfortunately, it's very much true of politics. It's very much true of media, fields that really shape our whole society. So then what kinds of voices get heard? What kinds of voices emerge in those fields? It's very troubling to think about then the larger implications.
I mean, I'm thinking also it's an economic concern, but it's also a cultural and social concern. Let's say you are able to get the internship, right? And if you don't come from a stable economic background, you know, you've got to dress for the internship depending on where you are. You've got to be able to do social things depending on what internship you have. And so I think that even if you can afford to do it, you're still at a disadvantage if you're low income. Right.
One of the most significant things is just the cities where these internships are concentrated, the rent, the cost of living, which has gone through the roof. I mean, if you think about, yeah, internships are in places like New York and D.C. and L.A. And to be able to, you know, to afford to stay even just for a summer, you know, it takes resources now, serious resources to be able to get into these fields. And it shouldn't be that way. And in many ways, it didn't used to be that way, because if you were getting paid a decent wage for doing the work, you could afford to do it and to enter.
What does the law say about this? You mentioned the Fair Labor Standards Act. I'm just curious, there have to be laws on the books that say if someone is working and providing a service, they should be paid for that service.
The Fair Labor Standards Act was part of this whole New Deal package that ended child labor, that established overtime, and it also established the minimum wage. But most internships in the for-profit world, the nonprofit world is a little more complicated because nonprofits are allowed to have volunteers. But in the for-profit world, you can't have volunteers, and interns were doing work, in some cases very sophisticated and important bottom line work. So interns began to sort of challenge this, bringing legal challenges against the companies that had not paid them. Part of why they had to do that was just because the Department of Labor was not enforcing these laws at all. So this is what people had to do. Some of those cases are still working their way through the courts. Unfortunately, in this legal environment, to get any kind of decision on behalf of people who are working is difficult.
Ross Perlin is the author of Intern Nation, How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. Ross, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
My name is Annika, and I'm calling from Middletown, Connecticut. I believe that internships should be paid, because when they're unpaid, only the rich can accept them, and that's not fair.
Hey, this is Jennifer Wolf calling from Los Angeles. In the summer of 1990, between my junior and senior years of college, I got an unpaid internship at a radio station in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and it changed the whole course of my senior year and pretty much my life. I mean, I'm still in radio, and now I pay it forward because I know what a difference you can make when you mentor someone.
Hi, this is Frank from Westbury, New York. Internships should be paid or compensated in some other way. Companies are making money off of people and need to give people something besides the prestige of working for that company.
Hi, this is Kate from Milford, Massachusetts, and I think if it's a few hours a week, it's fine for it to be unpaid as long as you're earning college credit, but if it takes the time of a job, if it's full-time or part-time, then it needs to be paid.
This is Holly Freeland in Portland, Oregon. My wife had a paid internship during graduate school. It was an important direct work experience in public health, and it led directly to her first job. Unpaid internships benefit people who have other means of support, which leads to inequitable internship access.
Internships should pay at least minimum wage and reimburse travel to and from.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.